66. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Supremacy Clause, Article 6, Paragraph 2 of the U.S. Constitution, states that federal law is the supreme law of the land. Yet for as long as our republic has existed, some have looked to the 10th Amendment and its reserve power of the states as a constitutional counterweight to the scope of federal authority. Even today, with a host of issues ranging from whether to accept federal stimulus money, to the use of medical marijuana, and to the setting of educational standards, conflicts continue to flare up over where to draw the proper jurisdictional line between the reach of federal power and the rights of individual states and citizens. States' rights advocates, who fervently cite the 10th Amendment in an attempt to push back against federal involvement in their states, have recently become to be known as tenthers, and some state legislatures are increasingly calling for the nullification of federal jurisdiction over a variety of social and economic policy domains within their state boundaries. Today on The Exchange, constitutionally speaking about the 10th Amendment. Our conversation is in tandem with the New Hampshire Humanity Council's year-long Constitutionally Speaking series, which explores our founding document and how we look at it today. Let's hear from you. What do you think of the current relationship between New Hampshire and the federal government? Which issues do you think are best suited for state control? Are there others where you think federal government could play a more prominent role? What do you think the founders intended the balance between federal and state jurisdiction to be? Call into The Exchange. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And I have two guests joining me for the show today. With me in studio is John Graby. John teaches constitutional law, civil procedure, federal courts and jurisdiction at the University of New Hampshire School of Law. And John, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Dean.
And joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Ernest Young. Ernest teaches constitutional law, federal courts and foreign relations law at the Duke University School of Law. And Ernie, thanks for joining us from D.C.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a little bit of history here. And Ernie, I'm going to go to you first on this. Why do you think the founders felt it necessary to include the 10th Amendment in the Bill of Rights?
Well, I think they mostly just wanted to reassure people who were worried about the federal government being too powerful by underscoring the idea of limited powers in Article 1. You know, they were referring back to the idea that the government has only the powers that are given to it in the Constitution. And the 10th Amendment really underscores that point by telling you not to read a bunch of extra powers into it. But I think it's equally important what it didn't say, because there's a parallel provision in the Articles of Confederation which said that each state retains all the powers that aren't expressly delegated to the national government. And they dropped that word expressly in the 10th Amendment. So it's a watered-down states' rights provision. And that's just as important as the addition of the provision in the first place.
Now, I have read that this was, in essence, an attempt by the founders to keep the states that were opposed to the new Constitution, to get them to basically buy in, that essentially what they wanted was a stronger national relationship between a central government and individual citizens. And this was just kind of part of the deal to get some of these states that were opposed to the Constitution to buy in. Is that a fair interpretation or not?
I think that's right. I think just about everybody who was paying attention politically at the time thought that we needed a stronger federal government than we had under the Articles of Confederation, but there was a lot of disagreement about how much stronger, and those are the disagreements become really salient down the line.
And John, your sense of the 10th Amendment, was this a good deal for the states, or just something that the founders felt they needed to include?
Well, my understanding tracks Ernie's. I think that ratification was very, very iffy. It was very, very dicey. It wasn't clear at all whether the new Constitution was going to be ratified. The charge to the delegates in Philadelphia was to strengthen the Articles of Confederation, not to write a whole new document. And a lot of people were upset by the document that emerged from Philadelphia, and there were a lot of people opposed to ratification. Several states did ratify, but only with the understanding that a Bill of Rights would be included. And although Madison was the author of the 10th Amendment, he thought it was unnecessary because he thought it was already clear that the rest of the Constitution was a constitution of delegated and enumerated powers. But nonetheless, there was so much concern about this, as Ernie mentioned, that they felt like they needed to include it.
So when Congress authorized a revision of the Articles, when they got to the Founding Convention, they essentially said, let's just start from scratch here. We're going to do more than just revise. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, imagine that today. That, and in fact, the Articles required unanimity for amendment. And the new Constitution, which, again, was not within their charge, went into effect with 9 of the 13 states voting for it. So you can imagine that this was a pretty controversial series of actions taken by these people in 1787.
And John, do you have any – I'm sorry, Ernie, do you have any sense of whether this was a difficult pill for some of these states to swallow? Or similar to what I asked John, was this considered kind of a reasonable solution?
Oh, I think it was a quite difficult pill. I think that the division – it wasn't so much there were some states that were really, really strongly for it and some states were really strongly against it, but there was a lot of division within each state. It was very dicey in New York. It was very dicey in some of the other states. I think Rhode Island was probably the most difficult. I mean, it had been an impediment to a lot of the kind of collective actions under the Confederation period, and even earned the nickname Rogue Island at one point. But I think at the end of the day, nobody wanted to be left out of the new government.
John, I mentioned at the opening of the show the Supremacy Clause. There's also the Necessary and Proper Clause in the Constitution. And to me, these seem to say that, you know, the federal government now has kind of overarching sovereignty and Congress can basically do whatever it needs to do. Say a little bit about those two clauses that aren't in the Bill of Rights, they're in the actual body of the Constitution.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, as with so many things in the Constitution, there are conflicting values expressed by different parts of the document. The Supremacy Clause of Article 6 says that federal law, and that means, of course, the Constitution, laws passed by Congress, treaties. Federal law is supreme to state law. You mentioned the Necessary and Proper Clause, also known as the Elastic Clause. That's the last provision of the list of specifically enumerated powers in Article 1. And it says to Congress, you also have this little bit of extra power here to pass laws that bring the enumerated powers into effective bring them into being in an effective way. There's a tension there. Ernie mentioned leaving the word expressly out of the 10th Amendment, which was in the analogous provision of the Articles of Confederation. I think everybody saw that this question of implied powers, unenumerated powers by Congress, was going to be controversial. And it was going to be fought out in the political process. And it really has been fought out for over 200 years.
So, Ernie, following up on John's comments, is the Elastic Clause or the Necessary and Proper Clause, was that intended in your view as a kind of a fairly narrow means of bringing about these enumerated powers, or was it intended to give Congress whatever wiggle room it might need to sort of bring the states in line?
I think it was a recognition that you can't possibly specify all the specific powers that the government is going to need in order to be effective. So Article 1, you know, gives the Congress the power to establish a post office and post roads, but it doesn't say anything about, you know, buying property to, you know, build post offices on. It doesn't say anything about punishing people who rob the mail. And these are all kind of implied powers that are necessary to make any sense of the power to establish, you know, post roads. And so at some level, obviously, you've got to have implied powers that the government can't function. I don't think the framers meant for it to be, you know, to become the dog rather than the tail. You know, the tail is not supposed to wag the dog. And the question is there any way to cabin the implied powers so that they don't just swamp everything else?
John?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that was the understanding. It was clearly going to be fought out at the margins. And even, you know, I mean, Madison and Hamilton, two principal authors, right, of this document, they quickly went to opposite camps and went into opposite political parties and fought about the extent to which there were implied powers under the Constitution. So I agree.
I've read and seen it suggested that to really understand the 10th Amendment, you need to kind of put it into the context of both the 9th and 11th Amendments around it. You don't hear all that much about the 9th and 11th Amendment. So, Ernie, let me start with you. Do we get any additional understanding of that 10th Amendment by putting it in context that way?
I think it's a useful contrast because both the 9th and 10th Amendments are really rules for reading other parts of the Constitution. They deal with a classic legal problem, which is that any time you articulate a list of things, the question is going to arise, well, what about the things that aren't on the list but are kind of like the stuff on the list? Are they in or are they out? So if you say the government has A, B, and C powers, does that mean, does that impliedly exclude D power, D, E, and F, or does, if D, E, and F are kind of like A, B, and C, does it implicitly include them as well? And the 10th Amendment says, no, everything that's not in is out, presumptively out. The 9th Amendment does the opposite thing with the Bill of Rights, because there was concern about articulating a Bill of Rights that people would read it as exclusive. So if you have a Bill of Rights that say you get speech, you get religion, you get some criminal procedure rights, then people would say, well, those are all the rights that you have, because the list impliedly excludes everything that's not on the list. And the 9th Amendment establishes the opposite default rule, I think, than the 10th Amendment. It says the list is not meant to be exclusive. There may be other rights that have to be recognized later on.
John?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I would add in, you know, the 11th Amendment is also interesting because the 11th Amendment was specifically enacted and ratified to overturn a Supreme Court decision, which was an interpretation of the original Constitution, which permitted citizens of a different state to sue the state of Georgia. But what's interesting there is that when you dig beneath it, and the 11th Amendment has come to stand for the idea that, you know, the inherent sovereignty of the states was taken for granted at the time the Constitution was ratified, and the continued inherent sovereignty of the states is to be taken for granted going forward.
We need to take a quick break now. Coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about the history of the 10th Amendment, and then we'll start talking about some of the implications for current policy debates. So please stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR is offering you a reprieve from summer gas prices. The early bird prize of our summer car raffle is $2,000 in gas gift cards donated by Irving Oil. That could last you up to a year. Tickets are $50 each or three for $100. Pick yours up at 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org. Mostly cloudy across New Hampshire today. Chance of showers and thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may contain some heavy rainfall. Highs today, mid to upper 70s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from the Dairy Field School, a 6th to 12th grade day school inspiring students to find their passion for academics, athletics, and the arts. Admission events all summer. Dairyfield.org/visit. And Ellen's Interiors, New London in Cambridge, Massachusetts, hosting artisans from Cherry Pond Fine Furniture July 18th at 6:30 p.m., discussing their craft and designs. Information at ellensinteriors.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, constitutionally speaking about the 10th Amendment. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. Please keep those short. And you can also post a comment on our Facebook page. In talking about the 10th Amendment today, I have two guests with me in studio. I have John Graby, who's a law professor at UNH Law School. And joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. is Ernest Young, who is a professor of law at Duke University School of Law. And I want to pick back up talking a little bit more about history before we get into the contemporary debates. Ernie, let me go to you first. Are there any key cases in your mind over the last 200 years or so that have really resulted in kind of tectonic shifts in how we think about the relationship between federal and state law?
Well, I think the critical shift is in 1937 during the New Deal. The court had really resisted the New Deal, and prior to the New Deal, we had a a sharply different conception of the relationship between state and federal power. We really divided up the world under a system of what we called dual federalism, where there were zones of exclusive state authority and there were zones of exclusive federal authority, and they weren't really supposed to overlap. And so what the courts did, they'd look at a state law or look at a federal law, and they'd ask, is it intruding on the other government's realm of authority? And if it was intruding, then it would be struck down as unconstitutional. But in cases like NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin and Wickard versus Filburn, these were the cases where the court shifted course, possibly in response to FDR's court packing plan, and really endorsed a much broader vision of national power. And at the same time, freed up the states to regulate in areas that they hadn't been allowed to regulate either. And after that, state and federal power were largely concurrent. They largely overlapped. And so the critical provision became not the Tenth Amendment so much as the Supremacy Clause, because the court's business became trying to figure out, well, when is federal law conflicting with state law and when does state law have to give way?
So, John, it sounds like in the grand scheme of our history, fairly recent shift in terms of our thinking about the reach of federal authority.
I think that's right, especially when you're talking about the Supreme Court being the source of the shift. There was another period, and it was the period immediately following the Civil War, where you could say there was another seismic shift. Following the Civil War, three constitutional amendments were ratified that placed eventually came to be understood as placing the states under federal supervision and the supervision of the federal courts. There was also the 17th Amendment, which was ratified in 1913, which said that we are no longer going to have our state legislatures pick our U.S. senators, but rather our U.S. senators are going to be picked by are going to be elected, popularly elected. And so the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 17th Amendments also might be seen as a seismic shift, shifting authority or making clear that the federal government has a great deal of authority over the states.
John's exactly right to stress the Civil War. A lot of people say that the most important case about federalism is Grant versus Lee and not any of the others. The other amendment that's crucial is the 16th Amendment, which allowed the federal income tax.
Right.
That's
mm-hmm.
really when the federal government got control of the money, which allows it to exercise a lot of leverage over the states by offering them money, federal money back, if the states go along with what the federal government wants to do.
So it sounds like the legal interpretation shifted in the 20th century as the federal government took increasing responsibility for the economy, for security, for all sorts of policy. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes.
I want to shift now. We can continue to talk about history as well, but I want to shift and talk a bit about how this is all playing out today. And I want to start with something curious that I noticed back in 2009. This was in a roughly one-week period. I heard at the time Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, at the time Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, and current Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana all within the same week cite the 10th Amendment as a reason for not taking federal stimulus dollars from the Obama stimulus package. Their fear was that this was in a way going to create some kind of unfunded federal mandate in their states once the funding ran out, and Pawlenty even threw in health care for good measure there. And I heard this idea of, for the first time, of a tenther movement. A group of activists and politicians who really kind of rely on the 10th Amendment as sort of a bulwark against the expansion of a federal authority. And I guess, Ernie, I'd like to talk about this a little bit, and I want to start by asking you, are we in a period where people are more frequently relying on the 10th Amendment as kind of a defense against federal sovereignty, or is this not unusual?
I think we're in a period where people are increasingly skeptical of federal authority. And if you look at the polling data, for instance, the Pew Center and other organizations have been doing polling about confidence levels in the different levels of government for a long time. And for much of the 20th century, certainly since the New Deal, the level of public confidence in the federal government was lots higher than public confidence in the state government. And I think that reflects the state's failure to deal with adequately with the Depression and with issues of civil rights and the environment. And you know, those numbers now have the state and local government significantly ahead of the federal government in terms of public confidence. And so it's not surprising that you're seeing not just, you know, the tenthers who are kind of, you know, fun to poke fun at, but respected governors and political parties and Supreme Court justices really pushing back and trying to revive the notion that federal power is limited.
But do you think are we in a fundamentally different period in terms of the scope of federal authority, say in comparison to the New Deal that you mentioned?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's too early to tell. Certainly legally we're not. You have the Supreme Court is now willing to say that there are some limits on Congress's enumerated powers. There was a period between 1937 and 1995 when the court refused to strike down a single federal statute on the ground that it exceeded Congress's authority. That changed in a case called United States versus Lopez in 1995, when the court said that Congress didn't have the authority to regulate the possession of guns in schools. But I don't think the court's ever going to take that very far. If there's change that's going to come, it's going to have to come, you know, at the political level. And I think you're seeing a little bit of a pushback at the political level. Probably the most important aspect of it is you see states not waiting for the federal government to solve problems. You see, you know, California, for instance, jumping in and trying to do something about global warming in the face of federal inaction. It's the reverse of the situation, you know, kind of in the middle of the 20th century when the states were failing to act and Congress stepped in.
John, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think it's important to emphasize that what's going on is not monolithic. I think there are people who sincerely believe that, people who study the matter closely sincerely believe that the federal government has gotten a little bit out of control, and that we have neglected the states as laboratories of democracy. And as Ernie points out, we see movements at the state level that, by the way, point in both political directions. I mean, we have, we have movements at the state level that are associated with more conservative political values, gun rights, for example. We also have the medical marijuana. We have end of life issues, things like that tend to get associated with the more liberal political values. But I also do think that part of what we're seeing is the Tenth Amendment and federalism also being a bit of a proxy for the period of hyper-partisanship that we're in as well. So it's difficult, I think, to sort it all out, to figure out how much of it.
Yeah. You read my mind on that one. That's an important point, because I think the conventional wisdom is that, well, you know, this has just become part of sort of the rhetorical arsenal of the Tea Party. And what you're saying is, well, no, it's really on kind of both sides. States are taking the initiative in ways that may bring them in conflict with federal law in ways that they might not have done in the past. Ernie, do you have any thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I think, you know, same-sex marriage is a great example. We would not have the debate in this country that we have about same-sex marriage if states hadn't gotten out front and decided to experiment. And I think that's been terribly important in shaping the national debate. And it required them to defy the federal government in certain ways. I mean, the federal government in the Defense of Marriage Act said, we don't want same-sex marriage, and tried to make life difficult for states that went the other way. And some states persisted and really radically reshaped the debate. I think that, you know, when we talk about, you know, the states as kind of instruments of hyper-partisanship, it's important to remember that may be a feature, not a bug in the system. I think it's a part of checks and balances that when you have one party in control at the national level, often you will have other parties in control, you know, at the state level, and that gives the out party a chance to kind of try out its policies, demonstrate their credibility. If they work, it makes them more able to challenge the center. And I think that's been a terribly important mechanism of American democracy.
So is it fair to say, John, I'll start with you, that the phenomenon we're describing kind of really transcends simply reaction to a particular presidency, that this is more of a kind of a systemic thing we're seeing over a longer period of time? It's not just about a group of conservatives trying to shut down the Obama administration.
No. I mean, I think go back one administration, go back to George W. Bush's administration, and there was tension there with John Ashcroft as Attorney General, committed to enforcing the Federal Controlled Substances Act, and insisting in the face of state defiance that federal law would control. And, you know, states out west, again, especially with respect to medical marijuana and, assisted suicide, for people who are terminally ill, states taking active measures to resist. That's in addition to the same-sex marriage issue, which Ernie mentions. That extends back prior to the Obama administration.
Yeah. Right. Go ahead, Ernie. Jump in, please.
Well, and the California Environmental Initiatives, the Bush-era EPA was not, moving very aggressively to regulate air pollution, and there was a lot of litigation about whether the California state law was preempted because it went further than federal law did in requiring people to reduce their emissions, and so there was a lot of conflict, but again, from the liberal direction.
I just want to let our listeners know that today on Exchange, we're talking about the 10th Amendment, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org. And I think whenever I think about kind of recent changes in the federal government over the last decade or so, I think you have to mention 9/11 and the impact that has had kind of on the reach of the federal government. John, your sense of how 9/11 has maybe changed the playing field a little bit?
Well, an event as awful and spectacular as that requires a response by government, no doubt about it. And the investigation that followed 9/11 revealed that we had a problem with, the left hand not knowing what the right hand was doing in terms of intelligence gathering and law enforcement. That naturally leads to a response at the federal level because of the magnitude of the threat and because it obviously required prosecuting wars in other parts of the world. That's always been understood to be the responsibility of the federal government. So maybe some of what we're seeing now in terms of resistance is discomfort with what we as a people demanded 10 years ago, which was security. It's always difficult to calibrate that balance between security and liberty.
Yeah. And Ernie, we have this. We've had this debate in the state about Real ID, which is this kind of national identification system that's been kind of proposed in the wake of 9/11. And New Hampshire decided not to go with the Real ID. How does this all fit together in terms of providing for security in the wake of 9/11?
Well, I think one thing that happened was 9/11 both enhanced our sense of national consciousness and our sense that the nation as a whole was confronted by these problems, but at the same time reaffirmed the importance of state and local government in meeting those sorts of problems. Because one thing that became very clear very quickly was that the federal government just simply didn't have the manpower and the coverage and the capacity to guard every reservoir and dam and nuclear power plant and so on. And so the states and local authorities, state and local law enforcement outnumbers federal law enforcement 10-1 in this country. It became a crucial part of the response to terrorism, and that meant that those sorts of authorities were going to have a say in how terrorism was combated and how investigations were conducted. And in some jurisdictions that were more worried about civil liberties, they were able to push back, and the federal government couldn't ignore them because it needed their help.
Yeah, John, I've noticed an interesting – following up on what Ernie said, I've noticed an interesting paradox. We've had this NSA scandal in which people found out that all these phone calls are being collected, et cetera. In some sense, I think it was – there was some outrage, obviously, but a lot of people kind of met it with a collective yawn that, okay, so the government in the wake of 9/11 is keeping tabs on a lot of this stuff. But at the same time, and maybe you could talk in the context of New Hampshire since you're here local with me, I talked to a lot of voters, and a lot of them seem to kind of be rediscovering their libertarian DNA and states' rights, and it may be a function of social media and talking to other people around the country, but an interesting kind of paradox there between increasing comfort with federal involvement, but kind of an increasing gravitational pull of these sort of libertarian themes in our state.
I think that's right. I mean, we're now a dozen years post 9/11, and the pendulum swings. I'm teaching a class at St. Paul's this summer as part of the Advanced Studies program, and I a week or two ago I gave them an article that Richard Posner wrote and published in The Atlantic magazine 2 months after 9/11, where he argued that our individual liberties expand and contract as the public exigencies demand, and argued that that's perfectly okay. he cites Justice Jackson's line, the Bill of Rights is not a suicide act, and he's arguing that, look, we need to recognize that our Fourth Amendment rights and even some of our First Amendment rights need to give way in view of national security. And I think, you know, if I'd polled people at that time, a lot of people would have said, yeah, right on. You know, the Bill of Rights is not a suicide pact. Now, 12 years later, people are taking a look at what has been wrought and saying, whoa. And I think you're right about New Hampshire. New Hampshire's always had a strong libertarian, ethos. And I think here those sorts of arguments really have great purchase.
Mm-hmm. Ernie, your thoughts?
Well, one thing to remember, and this is, it will shift a little bit from terrorism, is that states' rights and libertarianism don't always run together, because states' rights can include the right of the state to regulate at the state level. And oftentimes state regulation is challenged on the grounds that it goes too far and is preempted by federal law. So one of the cases that was important that the Supreme Court decided the last week of the term that was largely overlooked was a products liability case about generic drugs out of New Hampshire. And, you know, New Hampshire law was imposing a somewhat stricter standard on generic drugs, and it was ruled preempted by federal law, which was considerably more relaxed. And that's often the dynamic in cases about federalism, that a federal law is invoked not to have more regulation, but actually to have less.
Any sense of whether or not this I'm a big proponent of the impact of technology on law and politics. From either of you, a sense of how social media has maybe changed the kind of landscape about how people think of that relationship? John, your thoughts?
It seems to me, I mean, we all live in the context of our time. So, mm-hmm. I know that when I read the history books, that there have been other remarkable times, and the press was wild, you know, at the time of the founding and around the time of the Civil War, for example. But it does seem to me that social media, blogging, ready access to views that reinforce one's predispositions. My sense is that may be playing a role in our ability to, or inability, perhaps, to find common ground in these discussions.
I often tell my students that, you know, the founders talk. One of the reasons why, yeah, obviously, Federalist 10 with Madison, and, you know, one of the ways to prevent faction is that these different groups of like-minded individuals can't find each other. Well, now the web has allowed them to find each other, and that has had an impact. Ernie, any quick thoughts on this before we go to a break?
Well, I check my Facebook page about once every 6 weeks, so I'm not an expert. But it does occur to me that one thing that had been happening in traditional media was kind of a hollowing out of the local versions of that people weren't, you know, paying as much attention to local politics because, you know, the news was generally national. And social media, ironically, may make it easier for people to connect at the local level and get involved at the local level.
We've got to take one more quick break. We're coming up, we'll talk about some more policy areas, a little bit about the Supreme Court, and we'll take your calls and emails too, so stay with us.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new documentary on the dangers of fracking. Then former NPR reporter Mary Louise Kelly on her new spy thriller, all coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Diabetes and Endocrinology Center at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, providing comprehensive diabetes care to patients across southeastern New Hampshire. FrisbeeHospital.com. And Conway Scenic Railroad, celebrating a day out with Thomas, the Go-Go Tour, July 12th, 13th, and 14th, and July 19th, 20th, and 21st, ConwayScenic.com. 9:40, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we're discussing what type of president is the most effective president. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about the 10th Amendment. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, I want to jump back into talking a little bit about the Supreme Court. And John, I want to start with you. We had this recent Voting Rights Act decision, which said that I think 9 states no longer have to clear changes in their election laws with the federal government. Say a little bit about how that fits into the discussion.
Well, I mean, the Voting Rights Act is, of course, one of the signature pieces of federal civil rights legislation. Was enacted in 1965. It was enacted initially for a 5-year term, and then has been reenacted at various intervals. It is how that fits in with our discussion of the 10th Amendment is that the Voting Rights Act is clearly, you know, the provisions in question were clearly within the power of Congress to enact. They were within enumerated powers, specifically the power of Congress to enforce the 15th Amendment, which outlaws discrimination, racial discrimination in voting. The 10th Amendment comes into play because it was the perception of the majority of the Supreme Court that the continued operation of this statute, which was nearly unanimously reenacted just a few years ago, that the continued enforcement of these provisions of this statute were infringing on state dignity, infringing on the rights of states to fashion their election laws as they see fit, which is a promise made to the states, a guarantee made to the states in Article 1 of the Constitution. It's a controversial decision. It's always controversial when the Supreme Court strikes down federal legislation. It's particularly controversial when the Supreme Court strikes down longstanding federal legislation. It's even more controversial when it strikes down legislation that passed with such large majorities in both houses. So it's a great little data point for talking precisely about the issues that we've been discussing today.
Yeah, now Ernie, I've heard on the one hand people say that, well, this is just kind of a vestige of an earlier time, and so you might as well it's no longer necessary. And other people have said no, that this is potentially very problematic. What's your sense of kind of how this has played out?
Well, I think one interesting thing about the Voting Rights Act is it shows how a statute can be clearly within Congress's power at one moment in history and maybe not so clearly within Congress's power at a later moment in history, because the power that Congress exercises under the 15th Amendment is to enforce the provisions of the 15th Amendment, right? The 15th Amendment says that you can't discriminate on the basis of race in voting. And when Congress enforces that, it is limited to preventing violations of the 15th Amendment. So the predicate is that the states are actually violating the 15th Amendment. And when the Voting Rights Act is passed, obviously there are widespread violations of the 15th Amendment, and it was reasonable to have, you know, an extraordinary enforcement mechanism. And it's worth mentioning how extraordinary the enforcement mechanism is here, right? Because ordinarily, you know, states pass laws, and then people may challenge them in court or something like that, but that happens after the fact. The states don't have to go to Congress or to the Justice Department for approval before they can implement their laws. But that's what the Voting Rights Act required. No matter how small the change in voting procedures was, if you wanted to change the polling place in elections for a local utility district in Austin, which was a case the court heard a couple years ago, you had to go to the Justice Department and get their prior approval before you could do that. That's an extraordinary intrusion on the states, and it was justified by its necessity to prevent state circumvention of the 15th Amendment. But you got to show that circumvention is likely in order for that justification to work. And Congress, when it renewed the Voting Rights Act, didn't even make any effort to show that sort of circumvention was going on anymore. And I think that meant that it was clearly outside Congress's enumerated powers.
Now, John, are we likely to see this again in the courts, or perhaps Congress may sort of re-legislate aspects of it? What do you think is going to happen?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. Forces that ushered the previous legislation through nearly unanimously presumably are still there. There are other provisions of the Voting Rights Act that remain in force and effect. The Justice Department and individuals can still bring claims under the Voting Rights Act. But as Ernie mentions, they have to be post hoc now. They have to be after the state has violated the act. The prophylactic measures are gone. So I do expect that there'll be a fair amount of litigation. In fact, in Texas right now, there's already litigation about, you know, what the Shelby County case, that's the Supreme Court case from 2 weeks ago, what that means for purposes of some changes Texas wants to make to its voting laws.
I want to talk a little bit about medical marijuana and marijuana in general. You know, this is an area where we've just signed into law medical marijuana here in New Hampshire. Colorado has decriminalized small amounts of marijuana. And what strikes me as interesting in here is obviously this is in conflict with federal law. But in this instance, the federal government has decided essentially, on a non-enforcement policy. And Ernie, let me ask you, how does this fit into kind of constitutional powers, the idea that the federal government has the liberty to not enforce particular federal laws within state boundaries?
Well, I think there's two separate questions, right? One is whether it's a conflict if state law doesn't criminalize something that federal law does. And I think it's not necessarily. You know, there's all sorts of things like, you know, espionage, for instance, that federal law criminalizes but state law doesn't. It's simply a division of labor between the two levels of government. It does mean that given that most law enforcement is state and local, that if state law doesn't criminalize these small drug crimes, there's likely to be no enforcement, whether the federal government adopts an official non-enforcement policy or not. The federal government adopting a policy like that raises a difficult separation of powers question, and it's a question that we've seen with the Defense of Marriage Act, with some of the immigration laws, where, you know, Congress enacts a strict law, and then the president says, "I'm not going to enforce it, perhaps because I think it's unconstitutional, or perhaps, you know, because I just don't think it's a very good idea." Whether the president ought to be able to do that is a hard question. The Constitution says he has to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And if he can just say, well, I don't like that statute, I'm not going to enforce it, that's like exercising a veto, except it can't be overridden.
John?
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, though, executive discretion and prosecutorial discretion is not a new phenomenon.
Absolutely.
And we've had lawsuits actually in the past where people have tried to force the executive branch to enforce law, and the judiciary has erected prudential doctrines that basically say no, we're not going to let individual citizens force the executive to allocate resources in that way. So as of right now, that's a feature of the system that the branches have adopted. Whether we may revisit that in the future, you know, that remains to be seen.
Right, that they have some discretion. Let's go to the phones. We have Matt joining us from Concord. Matt, welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, yes, I have a question for both John and Mr. Young. If we curb, how he mentioned 10th, the laboratories of democracy, if we curb 10th Amendment rights, will that lead to less innovative legislation?
So can you say a little bit more, Matt, when you say less innovative legislation?
How we've reached, like, the medical marijuana laws and gay rights, will this limit our how we progress forward both in society and economically?
Ernie, you want to try that?
I think it will. I think, for instance, that if the Supreme Court had not revived the notion of limited enumerated powers in 1995, the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level might have looked different. It might have simply said marriage is always between a man and a woman in every jurisdiction in the United States. I think Congress thought it would not have had the power to do that in light of what the Supreme Court had said. But if they had been able to just flatly ban gay marriage nationwide and you hadn't got any state experimentation on that, I think the social movement in favor of it would have had a much more difficult time getting off the ground. And that's why the laboratories of democracy are so important.
John, your thoughts for Matt?
I think that's the benefit. I think that's the benefit of having the court intervene in these cases and invoke federalism or the 10th Amendment to create that space. The corresponding cost is when the Supreme Court intervenes in a way that does not appear principled or that can be seen or is seen at least by some as rooted in politics, more in politics and less in law. And so each of these instances, and Ernie's right, there haven't been that many of them, since the early 90s where the court has intervened. But each of these instances is profoundly controversial because a great number of people say the balance that between federal and state power that we have is something that ought to be worked out in the political process. It's not something that ought to be enforced by justices in robes in Washington. And that's an ongoing debate about the nature of judicial review.
Matt, thanks for that call. We have an email here from Val, and Val writes, "It seems to me that the amendments to the Constitution have been added to protect the rights of individuals over the will of the majority. This would imply that the federal government will increasingly act to protect individual rights over states' rights." And Val gives an example. For example, restrictive state abortion laws violating individual rights will bring federal intervention on the behalf of individuals. So, Ernie, if you could say a little bit about how individual rights may or may not conflict with states' rights in the context of the amendment, because as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the amendment actually mentions individual citizens as well.
Well, I think that sometimes the states are, if they're allowed to do what they want, are going to be, you know, have a more expansive definition of rights than the federal government, and sometimes it will be less expansive. And it just depends on the issue. The original purpose of federalism and states' rights is to protect individual liberty. It's to have the states as a bulwark against federal tyranny, and sometimes it takes a government to check a government. So I think the idea that the federal government will always be pro-rights is just not, you know, historically true. I mean, for most of the period before the Civil War, the federal government aggressively enforced slavery. It enforced the Fugitive Slave Law. It suppressed abolitionist speech in the North. Historically, it's just never been the case that the federal government was reliably, you know, more progressive on rights than the state.
John, your thoughts for Val?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I agree with what Ernie just said. One of the interesting questions, and I'm going to go back to a point I just made a moment ago, is this question of judicial review. To what extent should it be the judges who intervene into the political process to protect individual rights? And to what extent should the judges intervene in the political process to protect state rights? And should we expect that our judges or justices have consistent theory across, you know, the two contexts, one of which, you know, we could sort of loosely group with the Ninth Amendment, you know, in the protection of individual rights, especially those that aren't specifically listed in the Constitution, such as an abortion right, and then Tenth Amendment rights, the rights of the states to exercise sovereignty, especially in circumstances where there's nothing in the Constitution that really speaks to the matter under consideration.
And Val, thanks for that email. I want to finish up in the time remaining. We have about 4 minutes or so left, talking about the idea of nullification. When I was in grad school, I wrote a research paper about the South Carolina nullification crisis in the early 1800s, dealing with some federal tariffs. And increasingly, in recent years, I'm seeing the use of the word nullification in various state legislatures. We just had this veto by the governor of Missouri of a gun rights law that would have made it a crime for federal agents to enforce gun laws in Missouri. So, Ernie, say a little bit more about this idea of nullification and how it plays out in a modern context.
That Missouri proposal is unconstitutional. That's not going to work. The Supremacy Clause is going to block that. But there are practical ways of nullifying federal policy, particularly in all the areas where federal policy is primarily enforced by state officials. So New Hampshire's law on marijuana, for instance, is a pretty effective way of nullifying the federal drug laws, because the federal drug laws largely depend on state officials to enforce them. The same thing, you know, you could see the same thing in areas like environmental policy, where the EPA depends on state officials to enforce the federal mandates, same thing in education policy with No Child Left Behind. In all of these areas, state officials have been able to push back and say, well, we don't want to do it the way that you're telling us to do it, and been able to force the federal government to change its implementation policy a little bit, precisely by it, because the federal government depends on them to implement the law. And so there's lots of kind of de facto forms of nullification that fly under the radar that work very well and are perfectly constitutional and probably a good thing.
John, nullification a useful concept?
No, I don't think so. Nullification is as Ernie said, it's patently unconstitutional. You know, we fought a civil war over that idea, and we've rejected nullification. Earlier in the show, I talked about how in the political movement that we're seeing right now, there's probably a mix, or there is a mix of people who are sincerely looking at the issue, and that those who are using some old ideas for partisan purposes. It's hard for me to see those calling for nullification as anything other than the most extreme part of the end of the spectrum, and it just reflects politics.
Yeah, Ernie,
let me just flesh out a different example, though. So there was a lot of objections by state and local educators to some of the testing mandates and No Child Left Behind, that they were very intrusive, they were very burdensome, they were unlikely to help very much. And so, state officials were able to say, we're not going to do it. We're not going to conduct the test that way. And if you want to, hire thousands of more federal bureaucrats to come in and administer the test, then you can do that. But otherwise, you need to listen to our criticisms and change what you're ordering us to do. That's not all that different in principle from the idea that the states can sometimes block the implementation of federal law. But it's part of the normal give and take within our dual system of administrative and bureaucratic government. And I think sometimes that's really salutary, because the No Child Left Behind regime ended up being significantly improved.
John. I agree with that. I mean, I think the term nullification, connotes different things. And what I have in mind is, our legislature, a year or two ago, said that it was no longer going to accept federal funds or participate in any joint federal programs unless a reference in the Federalist Papers could be found that contemplated federal. I mean, that's sort of what I had in mind, but absolutely over on the other end of the definitional scope is what Ernie's talking about. And I fully agree. I fully concur. It's a feature of the system.
But it sounds like we're going to be continuing to hear the use of the word nullification, at least in a political context, for some time to come. As you can now hear, we are out of time. I could talk for another hour with you gentlemen, but we have to wrap up. I think we're going to continue to hear a lot about this issue in the coming political season. I'd like to thank both of my guests for a great hour. John, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
That's John Grabe. He teaches constitutional law, civil procedure, federal courts, and jurisdiction at the University New Hampshire School of Law. And Ernie, thanks so much for joining us from Washington, D.C. today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I miss New Hampshire.
Well, come and see us anytime. That's Ernest Young. He teaches constitutional law, federal courts, and foreign relations law at Duke University School of Law. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shield. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, filling in for Laura Kanoy.